Each argument. Just a friendly reminder before we begin to please turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. Also, I want to let you know that we do have microphones in the courtroom. They're very sensitive. The court can hear what's being said back in the roving room. So if you want to have a private conversation, you should do that outside. Thank you. The court will be out shortly. All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket today. Justice Lehrman is on her way, but as many of us had problems with traffic this morning, so she will be here, and the proceedings are being recorded, so she will view the entire argument. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 110282, in the interest of ER and others from Dallas County and the Fifth Court of Appeals District. Docket number 110367, City of North Richland Hills versus Laura Friend and others from Tarrant County and the Second Court of Appeals District. And 110732, In re Stephanie Lee, which is an original proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for the first and third arguments. In the second one, the petitioner has 15, 20 minutes for the respondent, and 5 for the amicus curiae. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. We will take a brief recess between the arguments. The court is ready to hear argument in the first matter, 110282, in the interest of ER.
The court, Mr. Martin will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I respectfully submit to the court that this is really a two-issue case. One issue is a fairly narrow issue of personal jurisdiction regarding the sufficiency of service by publication. The other issue presented in this case is a broader issue. Regarding subject matter jurisdiction, and specifically whether section 161.211B of the Texas Family Code is more akin to a mandatory statutory requirement, or whether it's in fact instead a jurisdictional requirement such that after the expiration of 6 months, a court cannot review an order terminating parents' parental rights. What I'd like to do is go through a very brief timeline for the court, a very, very short discussion of the procedural history, and then depending on where we are, I'd like to discuss the state's arguments regarding the importance of finality in the context of termination as a whole. On November 16th, 2006, the trial court entered temporary orders appointing the Department of Family Protective Services temporary managing conservators of Ms. Raybon's children. 4 months later, on March 20th, 2007, the caseworker who'd been assigned to the case spoke with Ms. Raybon regarding her address. A little over 2 months later, on May 25th, 2007, the department filed a petition to terminate Ms. Raybon's parental rights. 3 months later, on August 20th, 2007, three things happened. The first was that apparently the DA, or as I think we all understand as the district attorney, contacted the caseworker who was in charge of this case and told her that he or she had been unable to serve Ms. Raybon at the address that they've been given. Number two, the children's aunt contacted the caseworker and let the caseworker know that the children's mother had contacted the aunt regarding the children. And then thirdly, the caseworker spoke directly with Ms. Raybon on the telephone regarding her address, and at that point Ms. Raybon responded to the caseworker that she did not have a permanent address, was in the process of moving. And this is a little bit of a controversial issue because in the motion for new trial stage, which I'll get to shortly, Ms. Raybon filed an affidavit clarifying, saying, no, I didn't tell the caseworker that I didn't have an address. I just told the caseworker that I didn't have an address other than my mother's address where I had been staying while I was in the process of moving and finding a more permanent address. This address is the Barclay, B-A-R-C-L-A-Y, address that was given. On 4 days later, on August 24th, an affidavit in support of service by publication was prepared. The affidavit relied on hearsay. The affidavit reflected on its face a lack of personal knowledge of the affiant, the caseworker.
Was someone appointed to find Ms. Raybon?
To find Ms. Raybon?
To locate her before they proceeded with the...
The record doesn't reflect that there was anyone specifically retained to find Ms. Raybon. The only attempts that are in the record are the ones that are reflected in the affidavit in support of the motion for service by publication. There was also a series of attempts to locate Ms. Raybon on various public websites that record people's addresses and that sort of thing. But nothing in terms of picking up the phone and calling her. Her mother, for example.
Yeah,
yes,
okay.
Yes, ma'am. Exactly. this next date is really important. It was either sometime in August 2007 or September 4th, 2007. It could be both. It could be either. The record isn't clear. But at some point during that period of time, Ms. Raybon actually came to a pre-scheduled meeting at the Department of Family Protective Services offices and met with the caseworker that had been assigned to her children for over an hour. Ms. Raybon brought her brother, who was a veteran who had returned from Iraq, and they sat across the table from the caseworker for over an hour and discussed the situation with the children. Obviously, at no time did the department try to serve her with personal service at that meeting. And in fact, during that meeting, Ms. Raybon had no idea that the department was in the process at that moment of publishing citation in a newspaper. She had no idea, no clue.
She didn't know about the case.
That's an interesting question. What she knew was that there were some sort of proceedings going on with regard to her children.
She didn't have them.
That is correct, Your Honor. The children were no longer in her possession.
They'd been in the department's custody since November of 6?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. To kind of follow up on that, though, I don't think the record is clear as to what Ms. Raybon really understood the full import to be of these proceedings. There's nothing in the record that reflects that.
What does the record show about her educational level or what she might have been capable of understanding?
I don't believe the record speaks to that, Your Honor. I think as an officer of the court, I can say that I think that her education level would probably be commensurate with what the court might expect in this situation.
Her education level was what?
Might be what the court might expect in such a situation where the mother doesn't have a permanent address, the mother is moving, the mother obviously has had some issues and, to the point where the children have been taken from her.
Does that really make a difference insofar as the validity of the service, though?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. That's exactly right. And I think that's very important because the state argues over and over again about those merits-based issues. And I think it's important at this point to step back and say, yes, I understand that those arguments are there, but we aren't there yet. We don't get to the merits. We don't get to talk about what kind of person, what kind of mother she is until we have personal jurisdiction over her. And we don't have personal jurisdiction
over her. There's an allegation of notice, and the question is whether she understood what was going on, that her rights would be terminated at some point, that the department was going to move forward. They were no longer going to have these meetings and call her over. They were going to move forward to terminate her rights. And there's a question about whether she did have notice that this was going forward. So to that extent, there's some relevance on what she might have understood because that's an assertion in the briefs, right?
If I understand what the court is asking, the court is referring to the concept of actual notice, mm-hmm. Actual knowledge of the proceedings. I don't think I'm overstepping to say that probably 100 years of Texas and federal case law have held that actual notice, it does not substitute for proper service of process and does not give a court personal jurisdiction over an individual who has not been served with strict compliance of the service of process rules. So while on one hand I think the record does reflect that there was some actual knowledge of something, number one, we're not sure what that is, what the actual knowledge actually was, and number two, actual knowledge is not sufficient to establish personal jurisdiction. With regard to the The hearing on the termination that was held on October 25th, 2007. Then we have the order terminating Ms. Raybon's parental rights on November the 14th, 2007. And now we have the procedural history after that. Ms. Raybon filed a motion for new trial more than 6 months after the order terminating.
When did she realize that there was an order terminating parental rights?
I wish I could answer that question, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that question.
Was it before that 6 month period after the order was signed, or after, or do we know? Do you know that?
The record doesn't reflect. As an officer of the court, if it would be helpful to the court, I think I can explain that I don't know whether Ms. Raybon did. I know that her mother, whose name is Patricia Pippins, and she appears in the record, she did know.
So the children, not just the period that Justice Heck was talking about, but for 2 years after this order was signed, were not with the mother. Why did it take 2 years to file a motion for new trial?
And, Your Honor, of course, that's the 800-pound gorilla in the room. The Court of Appeals asked the same question. I wish that I had a more helpful answer to the court. The most helpful answer I can give is that my client's personal situation was such that this motion for new trial was filed as quickly as it could be in light of her situation. And I wish that I could expand on that, but I just can't. Nonetheless, the motion for new trial was filed within the two-year requirements of Rule 329, as the court knows. Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 329 permits a party who is challenging an order that has been rendered on service process by publication to challenge that order by motion for new trial for up to 2 years, which is exactly what happened in this case. In the motion for new trial, Ms. Raybon contended that the citation by publication had been procured by extrinsic fraud, and also challenged the sufficiency of the evidence to support citation by publication, again, the problems in the affidavit, and also pointed out the fact that there was, in the record, no order permitting service by publication, which I think is another problem. In response, the state argued that there was no extrinsic fraud. The state did not raise Section 161.211B. That's undisputed. There was a hearing. After the hearing, the court denied the motion for new trial, and the motion for new trial denial was appealed. In the appellate court, Ms. Raybon's principal brief argued again extrinsic fraud, raised the same evidentiary challenges. Incidentally, the trial court refused to rule on the evidentiary challenges, and Ms. Raybon objected to the refusal to rule. Once we were in the appellate court, in Ms. Raybon's principal brief, she argued extrinsic fraud, the evidentiary problems, and in addition, dropped a footnote and said, just in all candor, want to let the court know there is this section of the family code out there, Section 161.211B, which says you have 6 months. The three courts that have addressed the statute have all held that it's a statute of limitations, that it's subject to waiver. The state did not raise it in response to the motion for new trial, didn't talk about it at the hearing, and so it's been waived. But just so the court is clear, yes, that statute is out there. Yes, we're aware of it, but it was waived. The state's appellee's brief did not discuss Section 161.211. Reply brief was filed, and then shortly before oral argument, after the briefing was closed, the state requested permission to file an amended brief, raising for the first time the issue of 161.211 and arguing as a matter of first impression, that the statute is jurisdictional. A jurisdictional bar, 6 months, no matter what happens, it's not.
Well, let's assume that they didn't waive the argument and it's jurisdictional. What's the relationship between that statute and a person who is not served properly with citation? Would it be, is it void notwithstanding Rule 329 because the court never acquired jurisdiction, or so it has no effect? What's your strongest argument for rebutting the effect of 161?
The strongest argument, Your Honor, is the analysis in the dissenting opinion in Ray ER, Justice Murphy. I think just a fantastic discussion. Her conclusion is that Section 161.211B does not apply in this case, because 161.211 subsection B applies when an individual has been served by process by publication. And Justice Murphy's analysis of the statute concludes that the statute must at least imply valid service by citation by publication, because otherwise the statute's unconstitutional. You would have never had personal jurisdiction over the individual. And as a result, because in this particular case we have the extrinsic fraud, we have the failure to strictly comply with the rules for service by citation by publication because they knew Ms. Raybon's whereabouts, that therefore Section 161.211B does not even apply. That was her conclusion. The majority opinion doesn't really address that issue. The majority opinion all goes to whether it's jurisdictional or whether it's a statute of limitations. Of course, it comes up with the conclusion that it's jurisdictional. The dissenting opinion by Justice Murphy really doesn't go there. It just sort of stops at you didn't have personal jurisdiction, the statute doesn't apply, and that's the end of the analysis.
And so we just examine that as a matter of law?
You would amend, well, of course you have the standard review for a motion for the denial of motion for new trial, which is abuse of discretion. But I think in this particular case, when you're looking at whether service by publication, was rightfully procured, I think that is unquestionably a question of law.
What's the policy behind 161, would you say?
161.211, the policy as the state and as the majority have been touting is finality. It's important that we have a final resolution once a child is placed, once a child's relationship with its parent, with his or her parent is terminated. Then we need to have a final resolution so that the child can get on with his or her life.
Right. So children, for example, who've been now 3 years, 4 years without their mother, where are they now?
Your Honor, I wish I knew. And I actually, before coming here, did everything I could to find out. There are some confidentiality concerns and actually some channels that I pursued with folks who I expected would be able to find out that information were unable to. But I think what's important in this
case— They're no longer in the department's custody. They're placed somewhere.
I wish that I could answer that, Your Honor. I just don't know. I did try to find out. But I think at the end of the day, what's important to remember in this situation is if the court, in granting the petition, reverses the judgment, that does not mean that these children on the next day are being returned to Ms. Raybon. They're not. We just have to go back and actually have a trial on the merits in which my client participates with regard to defending her parental rights and trying to reestablish a relationship with her children.
Under your position, it wouldn't matter whether it's 6 months or 2 years or 5 years or 10 years later, since she was not properly served, is your position she could come back in and attack the termination?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I'm seeing that my time has expired. If the court has any questions, obviously I'm happy to answer. Otherwise, I'll
we'll hear from you on rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Duncan will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. In cases involving the termination of parental rights, judicial economy is not just a policy, it's a statutory mandate. The Texas Family Code is replete with provisions evidencing the legislature's overriding intent that cases involving the termination of parental rights be expeditiously resolved. To that end, Section 161.211 was enacted, in which the legislature expressly limited the time to collaterally or directly attack an order the validity of a termination order to the 6 months following the entry of the order.
But as Justice Murphy said in her dissent, doesn't that presume that service was correct?
Your Honor,
for that.
The plain language of the statute, Your Honor, does not address that. It expressly applies to the validity, to all challenges to the validity of a termination order. And as the Austin and First Court of Appeals in Houston have recognized with regard to the corresponding provision regarding adoption orders, that the statute does not provide any exceptions, not even on grounds that the order is purportedly void. And I would argue that that same analysis applies to this provision.
But so you're comparing an adoption to a termination of parental rights?
In 1997, the legislature amended the provision in section 162.012, which governs direct and collateral attacks to adoption orders. Previously, that provision had allowed 2 years to challenge the validity of an adoption order. In 1997, the legislature expressly limited that from 2 years to 6 months. And at the same time, the legislature enacted the provision at issue in this case regarding termination orders. The statutes provide the same language. They're reciprocal provisions regarding adoption orders and termination orders.
So what's the purpose of having someone served properly then? Can we just gloss over that?
No, Your Honor. My position is not to gloss over that point. She did have an opportunity to challenge the termination order on the grounds that it is void. She had the 6 months following the entry of the order to challenge the order. And petitioner has not shown any reason or why or presented any argument that couldn't have been presented within that six-month time period.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that I believe he used the term 100 years or so of Texas jurisprudence says if you don't have proper service, you don't have jurisdiction? You agree with him or you disagree with him?
My review of the case law does say that an order rendered in the absence of jurisdiction is void. However, as the cases that I was referring to out of the Austin and Houston, First Court of Appeals in Houston have referred with regard to the adoption statute, that this statute would apply even in an instance where the order was void.
So in your situation, if we have an invalid service of citation, if you have a judgment against a defendant who was improperly served, and the judgment's for $500, then that would be void and could be collaterally attacked for forever. Is that correct?
For whatever time period the legislature had set.
Well, if it's void, what limitation would there be on attacking that $500 judgment?
The legislature can set time limits for attacks on any order. The legislature has set many time limits, and it's not for courts to decide whether the time limits that are enacted are...
Even on an order when the trial court does not have jurisdiction over someone.
I think that even the issue of jurisdiction in a situation, in this situation, can be waived by a failure to attack it within the prescribed time period.
This is water under the bridge, but why didn't the FPS just personally serve her when she met with her caseworker?
Your Honor, the caseworker... That is also a good question, but the caseworker is not herself a process server. The record reflects that petitioner's participation with visitation, scheduled hearings, was sporadic at best. The motion for new trial transcript reflects that the petitioner would sometimes miss 3 visitations in a row. She would show up an hour late, and when she would show up, she was generally late, often so late the hearings had already happened, the 2 instances she did show up for prior proceedings, and even on the occasion that in August or September that petitioner's counsel is referring to, she appeared over an hour late for her 2-hour visitation.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If we determine the 6-month limitation is merely mandatory and not jurisdictional, is there still a path a victory for you? Do you have a non-jurisdictional argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Limitation defense cannot be waived?
Yes, Your Honor, that she was properly served with citation by publication. Yes.
Did she have actual notice of this hearing?
I think from the record is not clear on that, but the caseworker did testify at the motion for new trial that each time she spoke with petitioner, she gave her information regarding upcoming court hearings. So it does appear that she had actual notice. You could infer from the record that she had actual notice of the proceeding. The Dallas Court of Appeals correctly concluded that the language of this section leaves no room for a construction other than a requirement that any collateral or direct attack on the termination of parental rights, including a motion for new trial, be filed no more than 6 months after the termination order is signed. The statute does not include any exceptions. There is no provision for waiver in the statute, and nothing indicating that it is a statute of limitations or affirmative defense.
But this is kind of an odd statute because this really isn't a collateral. If the opposing counsel is right, this really isn't a collateral attack on an order. it is an argument that there was no order. The trial court never had jurisdiction over the mother and had no authority to proceed. Couldn't, the paper that he or she signed is worthless, and therefore the mother has a right to argue for retaining her children. It's not really, you know, what she is saying is it's not really an order at all.
That's, petitioner has in previous.
It would be like, it would be as if, some non-lawyer, non-judge signed that same default judgment. Well, that person never elected as a judge, doesn't have a law license. Who cares what they signed? It is irrelevant.
Respectfully, Your Honor, counsel for petitioner has previously acknowledged that that a motion for new trial is a direct attack on the termination order in the briefing. And the termination order itself, which was in this case signed by the judge having jurisdiction over the subject matter at issue, the termination of parental rights in the family court in Dallas, did sign an order stating that all persons served entitled to citation were served. And so the order it is an order in this case. There is a termination order at issue, and that is being attacked.
Did the mother have an attorney ad litem appointed to locate her before the citation by publication was usually, that's what I recall when I was on the bench.
Yes, Your Honor. There was an attorney ad litem appointed in this case, and as the family code provides, the responsibilities of an attorney ad litem include confidentiality and loyalty to the client.
But you look at the record of this attorney ad litem that was appointed for the mother, and she really didn't, there was no defense, there was no argument that service was improper. It looked like, it was about, two paragraphs at most that says, I looked through the record, the publication occurred on this date, and there's been no answer, thank you, Your Honor, and she sat down. I mean, it seems like, what's the purpose of that attorney? Isn't the attorney ad litem appointed to represent the absent parent at these hearings?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did that occur in this case?
All that I know about the attorney ad litem's participation is that's shown in the record. She recognized that the publication was ripe, and then the caseworker testified as to her.
Well, let me ask you. Typically, when trial courts appoint attorneys ad litem for absent litigants, the purpose of the appointment is to find the person. So in this situation, the purpose of the attorney ad litem would be to find the mother rather than to represent the mother. Isn't that correct?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. Yeah.
And so typically, it's my understanding, and certainly in my years on the bench, typically if the party was found, typically that attorney ad litem would get out of the case because there's a potential conflict because of having talked to all these different people. And so the purpose of the appointment is not to represent the interest of that client. And so in this situation, do you know, was the purpose of the appointment to find the mother or to represent the mother?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. I'm sorry, I'm not sure. All I know about the appointment and the appearance of the attorney ad litem is what is shown in the record after she was served by publication.
So there's nothing in the record indicating the attorney ad litem's findings in her search or his search to try to find the mother?
No, nothing beyond the fact that the attorney ad litem recognized that the publication was ripe, and there's nothing beyond that in the record.
Who makes the decision to serve by publication? Is it the department or?
Yes, the caseworker. After service by, in this case, after an attempted service, personal service at petitioner's last known address failed.
That was her mother's house?
That was her mother's address, yes, Your Honor. After that attempt failed and the district attorney's office notified the caseworker that attempt had been unsuccessful. The caseworker then spoke to petitioner in an effort to get an address directly from her. And when she did not give an address, the caseworker then searched state databases as well as various internet sources to try to obtain an address for personal service before resorting to service by citation by publication as provided for by the Family Code and the Rules of Civil Procedure.
But I'm wondering if the record indicates or if you know Was it the caseworker's decision to pursue service by publication?
It does appear that it was the caseworker who then sought citation by publication after.
Not the law, not the district attorney? Or
the district attorney notified her, the caseworker, that citation, that personal service by the constables had failed at the last known address. And at that point, the caseworker, who was the one in contact with the petitioner, tried to ascertain an address from her and then filed the affidavit of citation by publication.
I guess I wouldn't anticipate that caseworkers would ordinarily know much about service by publication. Looks like that's something that a lawyer would have to tell you.
In this case, I think the affidavit was most appropriately filed by the caseworker, since she was the individual with, acting on the behalf of the department, she was the individual with the who had made the efforts and was the one in position to file the affidavit of citation by publication, which was required.
Is there any question that the department could have found the lady if they tried?
I think that the record shows due diligence in searching for her.
No, but I know, but is there any, I mean, is there any question that they couldn't have, she didn't flee to hide herself, or there's no indication of that. She was around, she came to these meetings, and if she was suspected of murder, they could have found her in 24 hours, couldn't they? I mean,
I'm not sure that that's true. She said that she, her last address was her mother's address. And you look at the record regarding the motion for new trial that the mother actually filed a month after the termination order was signed. And in that motion, the mother attached an affidavit, petitioner's own mother, who petitioner claimed to have been living with. And the petitioner's mother states that she's not on good terms with petitioner. She does not let petitioner bring drugs into her house, and that the petitioner didn't do anything that the caseworker said she did. So even petitioner's own mother was not having luck communicating with her regarding these proceedings. And
that seems a little strange. If the mother says, I don't let her bring drugs into the house, to say she wasn't having contact with her, and to say the department couldn't find her when they called her and said, what's your address? I think it's a little, we kind of meet ourselves coming and going on that, it seems like.
Having a telephone, respectfully, Your Honor, having a telephone number for someone doesn't mean you know where they are.
Well, let me ask you this. The dissent points to the meeting in 2007 between the caseworker and Ms. Rayburn, and questions why she wasn't served at that meeting. Was the petition for termination already on file? And if so, it's difficult to say you couldn't serve her, because sometimes people will serve you right in the courtroom. They know you're showing up for something, and they serve you right there. Why couldn't they serve her? I mean, what's in this record to support that she couldn't have been served there?
There, as far as actual service, there's no indication that she didn't receive notice or even a copy of the petition for termination at that proceeding.
And I apologize, that was a lot of statements in one question. The petition for termination was on file.
That's
at
correct.
The time of that meeting.
Yes, Your Honor.
And service could have been requested for delivery for process at that meeting.
Theoretically, yes, Your Honor.
But it was not.
But was not.
Okay.
Because the record does also show that petitioner's appearance for her pre-scheduled visitation was very sporadic. And if the department would have had someone waiting at each of the meetings to serve her, someone would have been sitting at the department's office holding citation for her on any number of occasions prior to this as well, that she just simply didn't show up for.
Let's say Child Protective Services was very inappropriate in the way they handled the situation, and in fact, the service was not proper. Isn't it true that the purpose of this statute is to protect the child with regard to the child's relation to the adoptive family, regardless of whether CPS did or didn't do what was correct? And so, given that that's the policy behind the statute to begin with, then can you point to the language of the statute to support your position?
Yes, Your Honor, that's an excellent point. We shouldn't reach the question of whether the service was proper. The language of the statute expressly provides that notwithstanding the rules of civil procedure, the validity of Rule 329 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, the validity of an order terminating the parental rights of a person who is served with citation by publication is not subject to collateral or direct attack after the 6 month after the date the order was signed.
Shouldn't we presume the legislature intended to comply with the Constitution and therefore valid service was presumed in that statute? Why wouldn't they intend to comply with the Texas and the U.S. Constitution?
I don't think that this interpretation conflicts with the U.S. Constitution. The legislature can set limits for time to file anything in a case, including a motion for new trial. You do not have a constitutional right to file a motion for new trial.
Have one to be served.
You've got a constitutional right to notice.
Yes, Your Honor. You do have a constitutional right to notice. She was entitled to due process, and the statute sets an appropriate process. She was given 6 months to challenge that order based on the validity of the order for any reason, whether it was valid for lack of service or for any other ground that she would have wanted to challenge it. The legislature has set 6 months, and in interpreting the statute, we should presume that the legislature intended the statute to be effective as well, and that we should avoid an interpretation that would render all or part of the statute meaningless. And any interpretation other than that given by the Dallas Court of Appeals would render this provision meaningless and does not affect the legislature's intent to provide stability for children.
If the six-month provision in this statute always governs regardless of service, why would the DA ever serve? Just send a letter saying, we've got a hearing, and if 6 months passes, you win, without ever serving the person. Why would you ever serve if the service in this statute is irrelevant?
Because I don't mean to argue that service is irrelevant. The procedures for service should still be followed. Petitioner had the six-month time period to which to challenge the service.
Well, not to challenge the service.
To challenge the order rendered on the service, yes.
So why ever serve then? If 6 months is sufficient time to satisfy the constitutional concerns that you were asked about,
yes,
then why ever serve?
Because service is required under the Family Code and under the Constitution, and the steps are in place by the legislature and constitutional requirement for personal service, personal jurisdiction. These are requirements that the department takes very seriously and tries to comply with, and in this case, the record shows that they did try. We did try to serve
petitioner. Then you do acknowledge that under this statute, 161.211, there are requirements in the Family Code and the Constitution to serve the person.
And the record in this case shows service.
So the answer is yes.
Yes, Your Honor. The statute does refer to service by publication. And in this case, the record shows service by publication. The order, in fact, expressly states that it was that persons entitled to citation were served, and
when we're looking for clear evidence of intent to overcome the presumption against the requirement being jurisdictional, does that clear evidence in your view have to be sort of within the language of the statute itself, or can we sort of infer it from a more kind of broad purpose of a statute?
Yes, Your Honor, I would argue, may I answer? My time is about to expire.
You may.
I would argue that it can be inferred from this statute. Even though this court has generally declined in recent years to hold statutory timing requirements as jurisdictional, the court consistently recognizes that some requirements nonetheless remain jurisdictional, such as the requirement of a timely notice of appeal. This is a requirement like that requirement, that without the rules of appellate procedure regarding to when a notice of appeal should be filed, in this case under Rule 26.1 for accelerated appeals, doesn't expressly say this is jurisdictional. That's implied by the rules. And my argument is that this is much like that statute, much like the rule regarding notice of appeal, this is jurisdictional, even without those express words being contained in the statute. Unless there are any further questions, I will rest.
Appears there are none. Thank you, Ms. Duncan. The court will hear rebuttal.
May it please the court, I wanted to refer the court to a couple of cases that are cited and discussed in Justice Murphy's dissent. These are the Velasco and N. Ray Marriage of Peace cases, Velasco versus Ayala. These are both cases where you had service by publication, and the affidavit in support of service by publication on its face recited that the defendant's whereabouts were unknown, but upon further investigation, it became clear the plaintiff, while perhaps did not have a physical address for the defendant's residence, had contact, regular contact with the defendant, knew where the defendant's relatives lived, that sort of thing. In this particular case, we have a situation where there was very clearly continuing contact between the caseworker and Ms. Raybon over the phone. There's no allegation that she tried to call her cell phone and she didn't answer. They spoke on the phone regularly. It is correct that Ms. Raybon was late to meetings, late to hearings, that sort of thing. What I would submit to the court is that at this September, either August or September meeting, whichever the date actually was, I believe that it would have been worth the resources of the state to have a process server at that meeting on the outside chance that she showed up, seeing as they were in the process of terminating her parental rights.
What does the record show about, with respect to the attorney ad litem, does it show that the attorney ad litem sought to find your client or not?
No, Your Honor, it does not.
What does it say? What is the substance of the testimony from the attorney ad litem?
To the best of my memory fragment that I have regarding the attorney ad litem, it was a very sort of pro forma rubber stamp. I don't really have much to say, Your Honor. I know I'm representing Ms. Raybon, but it looks good to me. That sort of thing.
Was the attorney appointed to find her or to represent her?
The record isn't clear on that, Your Honor. It does not reflect that she was that the attorney ad litem was appointed to find Ms. Raybon. If I could go a step further with that, though, there really wasn't a problem with finding Ms. Raybon.
I mean, that's all what they it sounds like, because they're in contact.
Just call her on the phone. Right. There's no evidence in the record that they didn't just call her on the phone and say, hey, we're trying to serve you. Where are you right now? Wait there for 15 minutes. We'll have someone there. Never happened. If something as simple as that could have alleviated this whole situation,
can't, we would. Can't be too simple. You can't find her.
I respectfully don't have the same resources, I think, that the state might have to find her.
You've got a phone.
What's that, Your Honor?
You've got a phone.
I do have a phone. I don't know that I have her current phone number. I think that if I absolutely had to get in touch with her, I could. Without saying too much more about that, I am in contact with her, with her, the children's great-grandfather, and he's the one who I've been corresponding with regularly.
Now I understand that temporarily she lost custody, at least temporarily, in 2006.
Yes, sir.
Has she had any contact with the children since then?
I wish I could answer that. The
that you know of?
No, Your Honor. And
we're going on 6 years.
If I could go a step further, the children were originally placed with a relative. During the time that the children were placed with the relative, I do believe that my client had contact with them, but I don't know how long the children were with the relative, and I don't know the duration and whether they have been placed elsewhere at this point.
Mullane was decided 60 years ago. You think it's still good law?
Yes, sir.
The people used to read newspapers more in 1950.
They did.
And the point of the of Mullane is to try to act, to do something to get notice to the person. You wonder whether there's much chance service by publication is ever going to reach anybody.
The case law is full of references to this being the process, the service least likely to actually apprise someone, to actually let someone know the lawsuit's been filed. That's particularly not in our day and age. Well, that's it, then I'll cede my time to the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.